Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Adoption and Foster Care. I'm Dawn Davenport. As you know, I am both the host of this show as well as the director of creatingafamily.org. You will want to make sure you listen to the end because we're going to be talking about specific steps that parents should take to understand why they're being triggered and why their buttons are being pushed. Today, we're going to be talking about how to avoid triggering and being triggered by our kids. We will be talking with Dr. Tripp Aik. He is a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of experience in the field of child trauma treatment. He is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University Medical Center and an adjunct assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Dr. Aik is also the program director for the UCLA Duke National Center for Child Traumatic Stress, and he serves as the director of training for the Center for Child and Family Health. Welcome to Creating a Family, Dr. Aik.
Thank you so much for the invitation and really glad to be here so that we can have this interesting conversation. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic that we get a lot of questions about, but I do think that I'm not sure that we really all agree on what triggering per se is and how does that differ from the classic getting our buttons pushed that every parent should know, should and does know very well. So what do we mean by triggering and does it differ from just the general button pushing that kids can do?
Sure, yeah. So I would just say, When I use the word triggering, I guess I'm talking more about trauma triggers, things that are related to events that are either in kids or adults' lives that remind them of people, situations, places, things, or feelings that are related to an event that they experienced. And so we know that both parents and kids can experience traumatic events that threaten their life or their physical integrity or someone that's really important to them. Those things can really cause overwhelming sense of helplessness or horror and can produce, you know, physical effects such as, you know, their heart racing or rapid breathing. And those kinds of experiences later lend to difficult and adults exposed to those types of reminders that can be triggering to them. And the difference might be, and it's easier to talk about in the context of adults, there of buttons being pushed, right? As far as things that kids do either intentionally or not that are maybe annoying or difficult to cope with or especially frustrating for adults. And I think all parents have some of those things on their list of things that are easy for their buttons to get pushed. And so that will be a distinction I might make. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think we'll have to, as we go along, I think we're going to have to make that distinction over and over again, because is it a matter of degrees? It sounds like triggering comes from a significant traumatic event in the parent's past or the child's past. You know, you think of the classic PTSD where, mm-hmm. you know, somebody drops something loud and it brings back a mm-hmm. memory of doors being slammed or, you know, and violence ensuing, or the smell of beer brings back the terror that your parent is going to be getting drunk and then your mm-hmm. life will be very chaotic in the next day or type of thing. Mm-hmm. That sounds more like triggering. Am I reading that correctly?
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think the main difference is that maybe people are not necessarily going to realize in general what they are doing or what's unique about the situation that might be triggering for someone else, right? It's one of those things where the person who's had the traumatic event may be the only one that really notices what is triggering in the situation, as opposed to maybe an annoying child behavior that lots of folks could observe and say, yep, that's pretty annoying. That would be hard for me to deal with too. And so I think that those are some of the distinctions. And what's really interesting is when folks are triggered, it can be confusing to other people about why is Johnny scared right now? There's nothing mm-hmm. scary happening. Mm-hmm. Like no one else is scared, but Johnny, why is that? And it can lead to some really difficult conversations or missed opportunities, depending on how people respond to those things. So I think that that's another kind of distinction between those kind of things.
And I think so often with triggering type events with our children, fear is an easy one, not an easy one, but fear is one that's obvious and we notice. But when we see, it's harder when we see our kids' behaviors changing, and they're changing in ways that don't seem connected. They're more argumentative. They're angrier. They mm-hmm. are whatever. I mean, fear elicits a response from parents that is more sympathetic. But when you see your kid who's, you know, lashing out, being angry, sassing, mm-hmm. doing things like that, could that also be caused by the trauma, the past trauma coming forward?
Yes. I think that is a very common question that parents have about, you know, this is a behavior, how do we cope with it? And then it's not until later that the connections sometimes are made between what they're really struggling with behaviorally and triggers in their environment. Triggers are really tricky. They're complex. They're not easy to, you know, decipher. And so sometimes we talk with our parents about being trauma trigger detectives, right? About like trying to really think about patterns in an environment, things that might be particularly difficult as far as times of day or people that are there or certain situations that pull for those behaviors. And I totally agree that those more aggressive oppositional behaviors are harder to empathize with. But I will also say that the fear responses can be hard for parents if they can't make an obvious connection between fear and something that's happening. Sometimes they can say things like, "You're being so dramatic. Yeah. Right now," mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. you're such a drama king or queen, or mm-hmm. you are, and it really can undermine a child's experience if like they are feeling scared and there's a good mm-hmm. reason for them, but no one else knows what it is.
Yeah.
And so mm-hmm. I think that's something that we also see in parents, that they don't realize that maybe reinforces the behavior that they don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of trying to kind of identify what might be scary, even though other folks might not be experiencing it.
And I think I like the term trauma detective, because or trigger detective, I suppose, if mm-hmm. you want to use it that way. Because the reality is from my experience, most often kids don't know what is triggering them. They don't know they may remember the trauma, they may not, but even regardless, they may not know the thing that's happening currently mm-hmm. that is mm-hmm. setting them off. Do you see that as well?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that not only are the kids not aware, but I think that adults struggle too. So here's an example. So one of my shared this example of a child that was in foster care that went to a new family and was placed there. And the family realized that on certain nights of the week, and not every time the same nights of the week, child had a really difficult time at the dinner table. Some of those same behaviors that you just mentioned, Dawn, like yelling, screaming, you know, kicking, not willing to eat dinner. And on other nights, they were totally fine. They were totally fine. And it took a long time for this parent group to be able to kind of figure out like what might be happening. So in the end, what they realized was on certain nights of the week, well, every night of the week, the child sat in the same place. And that chair that the child sat in was across from a door. And the nights that door was open, the child had a lot of problems. Like, and the nights that door was closed had absolutely no problems. And that door led to a basement of the foster family's home, where nothing bad had happened to this child there, but in another basement prior to being placed there, a lot of really scary things happened, right? Mm-hmm. And so they realized if we just close the door, that is going to help us, you know, minimize a trigger that's very specific to this child's experience, and just did not have that connection made. And so I think that all the more reason for us to, as caregivers, to start thinking about what's in the environment that might be, you know, similar, why, you know, as far as these behaviors are showing up in these places, and how do we help, you know, tie back to a child's history to think about what might be triggering in this environment, what might be scary for them, but that's not for other folks. Does that help to have an example?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And I think it also shows the complexity of trying to be this trauma yep. detective, trying to figure out, because we think of things like words and things like that would be obvious, but it could be, what are some of the things or actions that parents take? Those seem more obvious, like if a parent raises their hand sharply, that would make that for a child who has been slapped or hit a lot, that that would be a frightening, it would be a trigger. But there, it doesn't have to be that obvious. I mean, the door is a great example because, I mean, that's, they were very, very good detectives because that would be really hard. But things like smells could can set people off.
Sure. Yeah. It could be sights, like something on TV. It could be smells where it's maybe a certain cologne that someone else wore. It could be sounds like sirens that are kind of going by, but we're reminding of a particular event. It could be places like a playground that seems like it's a really good, safe place for folks to be that are as reminiscent of something else. It could be colors. It could be people, you know, as far as in EMS or firemen or police, where kids may see them in a, an environment that's very safe and they're being very kind, but it could be a trigger for another time that first responders were involved. And so I think that, that's just it, is that it's not, it's to give parents a little, you know, a little bit of a breather or a little bit of credit. It may have nothing to do with what a parent is doing or not doing. It may have, but parents really need to take the time to take a step back before reacting and thinking about, is there something in this environment that could be scary for them that's not for other folks, so that they can give the child the benefit of the doubt. And that example with the door, you can easily see parents that are saying, you need to eat these peas before I let you get up, you know, get up from the table.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And like getting into an argument about like, I don't know why this was totally fine last night. You ate this last night.
Or more likely, if you kick that chair one more time, you will not eat the peas, nor will you eat the ice cream that's coming afterwards.
Exactly. And we're going to sit here until like, you know, until, you know, the next, the next week or two goes
till the cows come home. Yep.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You know, going back to the place, one of the things that we have found, and we run Creating a Family, doesn't run, but we have curriculum for parent support groups. And we often encourage, one of the hints, let me back up, one of the hints is to get parents to attend, is to make certain that you also have child care, but also teen groups, tween groups, child groups, things like that, but certainly child care. And we point out and want our group facilitators to think through their location, because for many children, the DSS office or the child welfare office, if they if the child associates that with having been removed, that's probably not going to be the best place for you to have your child care or your parent support group, because you may see a lot of children who are triggering. So that's an example. Let me give another example from our experience at, here at Creating a Family. Dates can also be a triggering. We have a number of families who, we have a large online group, and this has come up, and the number of families who talked about a time of year or oftentimes it's not a specific date, because sometimes children aren't aware of specific dates, but they may be aware of the time of year. And I remember one example was, it was near Halloween, but it was times when the weather changed and the child's behavior always went downhill. And the parents, and they got to the point where they were anticipating it. And then at some point, they were good detectives and they realized that it was at that time of year that the child was, the event happened that, that forced the child to be removed, or the children to be removed from their birth home. And they were able to connect the two. And and so dates or times of year can also, Christmas can be very triggering for many kids.
Sure. And I think that's a great point, Dawn. And I would just say that I think it's probably very akin to the discussions we have in the grief circles, right? That we talk about, you know, where there are dates and times that kind of come out of the blue where people who have lost others, and this is very relevant right now in the, our COVID timeframe of having not only anniversaries or birthdays or holidays that the person is not there for, but just certain times that you didn't quite anticipate that would kind of go out of the blue. So I think that that's, if folks have had experiences like that, then it may be easier to relate or understand how kids may have some of those same kind of things that you're talking about, and the opportunity to think about how do we prepare for it but not like force it to happen, because it may be that it doesn't happen every year during that time for kids or for families, or it may be that there's a way to offset that by thinking about what's something fun or positive or that we can try to plan for during a time that typically is difficult, not to, you know, deny kids the opportunity to voice that they have struggles or concerns, but to try to, you know, provide new opportunities for kids to associate other kinds of events during that time of year as well.
Absolutely. And one of the things that came out of this discussion in our group was to, one of the families was going to just had, it was fall was their issue. And they realized they needed to plan less. They needed to simplify fall. They needed to be home more. They needed to be, they just needed to be less busy in the fall, you know, so that meant needing to think through sporting activities and things like that. For this family, that was something that they chose, and I believe ended up working relatively well for them. Let me pause here for a minute to tell you about a free educational resource. Thanks to our partners, the Jockey Bean Family Foundation, we can offer you 5 free online courses through a creatingafamily.org's online parent training center. When you go to bit.ly/JBF support, that's bit.ly/JBF support. You can see the 5 courses, like disciplining while maintaining attachment. That's one that's directly relevant here. There are other courses that will really help you. They are free, and they are free thanks to the Jockey Bean Family Foundation. You know, we've talked a lot, and it's easy. I think it's so often we as parents, it's easier for us to focus on our kids, but we as parents also come to the table with our own issues, our own traumas, and we're gonna shift in a bit to talking about our own buttons. but sure. before we move there, let's talk about our own traumas, and you're describing children who are reacting in ways that are peculiar to us, the outside looking in, because they're either scared when they shouldn't be, or angry when our perception is they shouldn't be, or at least their reaction is greater than it should be. Mm-hmm. Talk to us some about parents who come who also bring that to the table.
Yes. Yeah. I think that, you know, given the statistics that we know about child trauma, our number of adults, including resource parents, who have their own histories. And sometimes folks are very aware going into this kind of role of resource parent that is something that they need to kind of keep in check and think about and be connected to good social and professional supports. And others may have seasons where they need to kind of revisit that. But I think that where it shows up sometimes is we haven't identified trauma that a child has disclosed before they come into our home. And like we don't have experience with that, and we feel like we can support them. And then once they come into our home, maybe there are other events that are disclosed that are things that we have experienced, right? Where like we weren't sure that we could easily provide support to a child that has a sexual abuse history, because maybe that's something that we've had. Mm-hmm. But the child that initially comes in has witnessed violence in their home. And then we find out later that maybe they have some of those same events that we have in our lives. I think that those can be especially important to find support around, because there may be either behaviors or conversations that kids want or need to have that caregivers with those same histories may struggle to support. And so I think that that's something just to kind of keep an eye on and to have other adults to talk with. I think that the other thing is that I see is that sometimes caregivers use their kids as a sounding board for their own struggles. And I think that we really need adults to find other adults to do some of that work so that we're not, you know, putting burdens on kids in ways that maybe we don't mean to or want to. And also just thinking about the conversations that we have with other adults need to be in times and places where kids are not hearing them. There's sometimes that I think that I'm really surprised sometimes where parents are like giving a lot of detail about either their own experience of trauma or something that they observed in a child where a child's very close by and taking it all in. And I'm thinking maybe that's a limit that we need to kind of
Yeah.
Think about like, so that we're not making this child kind of be the filter for like what they should be listening to or not. So I think those are some things that come to mind as I think about adults with their own trauma who are fostering or adopting or providing kinship care to.
You know, a scenario that I think happens pretty frequently in the resource parent and adoptive parent scenario is that, and whether we call this trauma or not, I guess is debatable, but parents enter becoming a foster parent or a resource parent because they have a need to be loved. They perhaps had not, they didn't have an affectionate family or they felt unimportant. And so in their life, in their adult life, they want to recreate a situation. They want not recreate, they want to create a situation, a happy family. They want to create a family that provides them with this love. And enters that family a child who has been removed from their family, who is not seeking this. This is not a good thing from this child's perspective. How does that play out? And have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that that scenario doesn't sound totally unfamiliar. I think that there are a lot of assumptions I think sometimes resource parents come to the table with that really need to be challenged, right? Around what are your intentions? What are your motivations? What are your expectations of kids who are coming into your home? And a lot of times there are some beliefs that we have about the ways kids should be or the way that they should be. Or the, you know, that my love for them should be enough, or that, or that I can they protect
should,
them.
They should be grateful.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm making this
exactly. And that is not a great place to enter into that kind of relationship, because if they're looking for, you know, confirmation of these, what we often refer to as myths, right. And resource parenting, like that's not a good kind of approach to go, then they're going to be disappointed probably. Right.
Yeah, definitely.
The kids are not saying, within the first week of being placed there, how grateful they are or how, you know, they've really looked for this caregiver all their life or, you know, those types of things. And so I think that,
or you're so much better than my birth mom, or you're so much better than my dad. Or
exactly. Which is not a fair assumption for kids to, nor that we, or a reasonable expectation, right. For us to think of that. But I do think that as caregivers enter into this work, they really have to do some work on themselves to determine kind of why are they ready to do this? What are supports that they think they'll need? What are some of the showstoppers that might get in the way? And what, you know, what are some things that they may need to be challenged on? And I often see this in parents that have parented their own biological children or have fostered for years and have had like a certain set of experiences where they believe that all kids kind of fall into a specific category. And then they have one child that's very different than any of the ones that they've ever fostered or any of the ones that they've ever kind of cared for. And they're not prepared for like, well, this is just such a different set of behaviors, or they're not responding to the ways
they're
that
not responding. Exactly.
Parent. And so we have to take an individualized trauma-informed approach as we do parenting. And sometimes that takes changing the way that we typically do things.
I would say not sometimes, it's probably always.
Yeah. I'm trying to be fair.
Yeah. I'm just trying to soften the blow there. But I also think that that's parenting in general, that anybody who has more than one child, regardless of whether they enter your home through birth, fostering, adoption, or kinship care, it's tempting to, you know, we learn one thing and then it's hard to learn to do it a different way.
Sure.
Kids respond in different ways, and so we have to as well. Is today's podcast hitting home for you? Do you have friends who would appreciate this practical information about triggering and button pushing? If so, please tell them about what you've learned when listening to this podcast as well as our other podcasts. We would love to strengthen and inspire more families to raise strong, healthy kids. And if you want to help us, the best way is to spread the word about this show. Thank you. All right. So now we've talked about the trauma causing a triggering. And is it fair to say that in some ways the button pushing or the over annoyance that we're on a continuum? It seems like that when kids push our buttons, It's that we can recognize it because we can look at our, I mean, recognize it, that our, it's us that's bringing something to the table because our reaction is oversized. We are responding in a way that is bigger than the event would necessarily dictate. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So is it fair to think of it on a continuum that triggering is one end being caused by a traumatic event, but I don't know that button pushing is necessarily caused by traumatic events. It could, but we also are reacting in a way that's not productive. Is that a fair mm-hmm. assessment?
I think so. I might even put it on like a stress continuum, right? Where for those who've had traumatic experiences, on one end, there's a traumatic kind of response or traumatic stress, and that all of us experience stress in general continuum, right? Like that we have that we have stress, and that as a parent, dealing with stress gets hard. It's kind of like, you know, if you overwork a muscle, it's going to get tired. That's what I think of for button pushing, right? Of like mm-hmm. on your most relaxed, patient-filled day that maybe you could tolerate a behavior pretty well, right? But on a day that you've been stretched, that you had a really hard day at work, that you didn't get enough sleep, that you're feeling kind of like you've been multitasking with lots of different, you know, burdens, the same behavior on one of those days may be really much more difficult to tolerate. And so those are, and it may be that some kids in your house pull for certain certain responses in you, right? Like it's like, if this behavior happened with another kid, I probably would be okay. But when it's you, it's really hard for me to be patient and for us to recognize that that's about us, right? That that's, you know, the behaviors are things that we certainly want to be able to respond to, but there are buttons, there are hangups, there are, you know, things that we have difficulty tolerating. And so how do we manage that? Or how can we take a step back? Or how can we make a decision to not jump in with the biggest consequence or rule that we've ever thought of in the heat of the moment versus taking a step back and making sure that you're making a good decision about things that you feel like you want to kind of address?
Yeah, grounding a child for life is usually going to bite you in the butt later on, you know, just
it will. Perhaps, and you're grounding yourself. You're not just grounding a child. The parent is totally going to be grounded too. And so I think that's another thing to consider when you're making this.
Yes. Felt good when it came out of your mouth, but by golly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now I have to enforce it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or not, when in both cases are problematic.
Right. Right. Right.
So how do we recognize, I mean, honestly, in the heat of the moment, it feels justified that if that kid is clicking that pen, you know, constantly, that my reaction of wanting to strangle them feels like a logical response. Mm-hmm. So how do we recognize that our reaction is not in keeping, that it's something that we're bringing to the table?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great question. I would say, you know, if we've already kind of filtered the situation through a trauma lens, right? If we've done that first and said, is there anything that could be scary or reminiscent or reminder, you've kind of done that detective work. Then the other filter after that to me would be to kind of go through and say, is there anything about me mm-hmm. and the things that I really struggle with that I need to filter through this before I respond, about like, I am especially annoyed by fill in the blank. Like it's, and I know that that's just me, like my partner or the rest of my family or other adults, like do not have the same level of annoyance with this thing that I do. And so it may be more about me. And how do I taper my response, or how do I maybe ask for someone else to help in those situations, or how do I avoid, or how do I, you know, calmly talk about things when things are calmer? That's in general, the best advice is to address behavior or changes in the schedule or the routine or the rule set when things are good, right? When things are at a very calm place, and to say, hey, like you were saying earlier, that pin, you know, like using that pin over and over again, I know that's not annoying to you. It kind of is to me. And I'm wondering, is there something that we can do about it? Like, is there, because it's, could you help me with this? Mm-hmm. In some way, because I'm really struggling with it, and I could just leave the room, but there's a lot of pins all over the house, and I'm really worried that that this is going to be something I'm going to struggle with. Mm-hmm. And then knowing when to seek help, you know, maybe there's something that's a bigger annoyance and or your response is really reinforcing the behavior you're trying to address. When to get help, where maybe it's help for you individually, but sometimes it's, you know, there are a lot of good evidence-based treatments for families to address behavior as well. And it might be that those are strategies that families might take.
And this is probably less button pushing, but I do think as parents responding to poor behavior, I think sometimes our reactions or overreactions, and I'm giving air quotes to the over part of the reactions, are fear-based, that they are based on our fear of a couple of things. Gosh, think of the things that we could be afraid of. One, that this behavior will continue and that they're going to be a, you know, they're going to be a 30-year-old who is still doing this, or a, but it can also be fear-based in that this child's behavior, what this child is doing is a reflection on us, and that we're going to be perceived, that their bad behavior means that we are bad parents.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, one example might be to just say, take the same behavior, plop it down into your living room when there's no one else there, and then take that behavior and plop it in the middle of a family reunion.
That's painful.
and does the same behavior pull for the same response in us, right? And if not, then it may say something about like our worry about Aunt Joan really being offended that this behavior happened, or that Uncle Jimmy's going to give me a lecture on how I don't know how to parent again, or you know, those kind of, and that we're trying to avoid that, right? We're trying to kind of, we're going in, we've had the talk before we got out of the car for the family reunion about the thing that I don't want you to do. and like, we're really hypersensitive about it. So yeah, I think that those are definitely things for us to consider. And it may be that we just have to kind of, you know, consider how much of our response is about the very thing that you mentioned, right? About like, I'm worried that other folks might see me as unable to kind of handle this. Or maybe I've had a well-meaning person give me advice unsolicited before in public. I've seen this happen and I'm just like, that's really impressive. Like that you thought it was okay to tell somebody how to parent that you don't know. But see that. And then that we're trying to kind of avoid that response. But the other piece of this, Dawn, I would say, maybe you can relate to it, is I think that sometimes parents forget how old their kids are.
And what do you mean?
That there are different responses that are needed depending on developmental age and appropriateness too, right? That maybe our kid is really smart and they're very verbal, but they're like three. And so we have to still keep in mind that like three-year-olds do this thing that this three-year-old is doing. And even though they have a lot of words, they're still going to tantrum sometimes. And they're still going to do these things, like they're built to do these things based on the age that they are. I mean, I remember back when our oldest was in the kind of period, what we call the period of purple crying, right? That 6 week, 7 week, we see a huge increase in crying no matter what you do. Now, like whether you've changed diapers, you've been fed, it doesn't matter. Most babies are in between, I don't know, I think it's something like 6 to 10 weeks, have a huge increase in crying. It's just developmentally what they're supposed to do. And some parents don't realize that. And there's whole prevention programs like shaken baby syndrome prevention programs focused on educating parents that, hey, did you know that kids cry more during these weeks? So that maybe you will respond differently and you'll just know that that's important. I think those are things kind of across the developmental span for kids for us to keep in mind about, am I treating or am I expecting more from a child than they can do based on their age? Or maybe it's the opposite. Maybe I'm like not giving them enough credit that they could do more, but I'm planning on like doing more for them. I'm not sure. But I do think that that's something that sometimes parents or caregivers struggle to remember, me included.
Yeah, well, we could all be in that boat. You know, and I think it gets, I was really focusing what you said about the verbal child, because you're right that kids who seem, for a variety of reasons, perhaps they are more verbal than the average child. Or we also see kids who are bigger than the average child, or taller, or more mature looking.
Yeah.
And our expectation is we look at the child and forget that, okay, he's eight. Yeah, he really does look 12, but he is eight. And he is going to behave like an eight-year-old, which means he's going to bounce off the walls at times because he's not 12, he's eight. So I think that that is something that I hadn't really thought about that. And even though we intellectually know he's eight, it's easy. It's easy for everyone just to forget. It's also then easy for us to forget when we're in public because we know we're getting the side eye from Uncle Joe because he's bouncing, you know, Junior's bouncing off the wall. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Dawn, one thing I'm thinking about is, you know, it may be that caregivers are like, so what do I do? What do I do when Johnny is doing the annoying thing that maybe he's supposed to do because he's that age? I don't know. But I would say in general, most behavioral kind of programs, therapies, evidence-based treatments, approaches, kind of just talk about praising up the thing you want to see more of very specifically and often, ignoring ignorable behavior. Those are the kind of the two basic concepts that we talk about when kids engage in like whining or, you know, just like really kind of annoying behavior, trying to actively ignore the when you can those kind of behaviors, because if we give attention to it, even if it's negative attention, it's going to increase, right? Absolutely. So that what that means is that you're then praising for appropriate talking, right? Or praising for the positive opposite of whining. Like, what is the positive opposite? It is like speaking in a big, if it's a younger kid, in a big boy voice, or using big girl words, like praising those things that help us get out of whining. But if we pay a lot of attention to it, even if we're trying to address it, it will increase. And so I think that's hard, especially when they're kind of annoying behaviors that we just want to stop. We want them to stop. Mm-hmm. But it is you're more likely going to reinforce a behavior if you give a lot of attention to it. Now, there's some things you can't ignore, right? We recognize that. And that's really important for the safety of kids to know about those things. But I'm thinking that there are a lot. And we talk with parents a lot of times about how to ignore, because some people think that they're ignoring when they're not.
Give me an example.
So I've had this one parent tell me once that she was in the grocery store and the child was asking for a candy bar in the candy aisle. And the parent said, I've already answered that question. I'm just going to ignore you. I'm not going to talk to you at all. I'm not going to say anything to you because I'm not giving you the time of day. I'm going to ignore you. I'm not going to say anything. Right. And I was watching this mom tell me this. And I said, so did you keep saying things like that after? Like, did you keep saying that? And she said, yeah, I wanted him to know that he was being ignored. I said, Do you know that maybe he wasn't being ignored because you kept talking to him? That like it was one of those things where like kid was maybe translating that to I'm getting a lot of attention right now, or like I'm still getting mom to talk to me even though she's saying she's ignoring. And so I do think that like thinking about if we're ignoring, what's a safe way to do that, and how do we actively ignore is something sometimes people need coaching on. But I think that's an example that kind of comes to mind for me.
One of my eldest daughter, when she was three, was being annoyed by a child in preschool. And I was talking to her about it. And I said, you know, the best thing you can do is just ignore them. And the teacher told me the next day that my daughter turned to the little boy who was doing it and just started screaming, ignore, 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 ignore. The teacher said, I think you maybe need to give her a little more examples, or she needs a little more advice.
But good for her for trying. Like, that was a good first step. But I do think that it's reminiscent of that sometimes. And I know that caregivers are just doing the very best they can.
Exactly.
I know that. That they are.
Let me ask about another one, because this has come up some, and particularly with parents of tweens, even teens, I suppose, but disrespect. Is that an ignorable? It is certainly annoying, and it can also be triggering. I think for depending on what we bring to the table and our feelings of respect that we deserve, or having been disrespected or whatever in the past. Yeah. But even if it's not to that extreme, let's just be honest, it's extremely annoying. And I also personally think it's it's just really unhealthy for family dynamics. So having said that, is that a, I mean, certainly the praising part when our children are being respectful, praising them, although that seems a little over the top, you know, if somebody doesn't give you a lip, then you're, you know, saying, thank you for being respectful. Although that certainly would work. So is that an ignorable thing?
Well, let me address a couple of things you just said. So the over-the-topness, I think that sometimes we worry that we're going to praise our kids too much. Mm-hmm. And what I'll say for especially for younger kids, but also for older kids, is that that's a myth. typically, we're looking for 6 praises to 1 correction as far as a ratio, especially for young kids. They need to hear it often, even for things that they're able to do or that they understand or that they've done before. That is not going to spoil them, right? It's only going to help, you know, reinforce those things. Sense. But I think for the respect comment, that is something that a lot of people focus on. But here's the thing. If we asked 10 parents, could you label the top behavior that if we were watching on a video camera would show respect? Like if we could just turn the sound off, or even if we turn the sound on, what's the behavior that we would see that is respectful when we're talking about show me respect or don't be disrespectful? And you would probably get 10 different answers, right?
That's for showing respect, not disrespect. You're saying that's you.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. What does respectful behavior mean? Which is, you know, we could also say, what do people complain about being disrespected? What's that behavior, right? We could do it this either way, but I think it's going to be 10 different responses about like what showing respect means. And that's a problem when it comes to for kids to know what to do or what to expect if there's 10 different kind of responses to what showing respect is. So we have to break it down to very specific behaviors that we mean about being respectful, right?
It's easier to define disrespect, I think.
And maybe so, but I guess in my mind, it should be just as easy to find the positive opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Or to at least define the disrespect, because that would also differ. Because what one family thinks is just good-natured kidding, another family might find disrespectful.
Exactly. So I think that's that when we start praising very specifically about things that are respectful, I think that helps, right? To say, I loved how you said thank you all by yourself without me having to prompt you. Mm-hmm. Like that was great. I loved it when you said that earlier. That's a way to promote a respectful response. Or I loved how when I told you we couldn't do this thing, that you were so calm about it. That was great. I loved how you did, because then it's kind of showing like respect is when I say no about something that you don't give me sass about it, right? So I think that we have to break it down into very much smaller behaviors, especially for young kids, about what being respectful means. Because it's kind of like if you walked into a kid's room and said, I would like for you to clean up. I'll be back in 5 minutes. Make sure that, you know, and then they come back and they're really upset that one very specific thing that they had in their list of what cleaning up means didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's a similar thing when we're saying, be respectful or be polite or be nice, or you know, those kind of very indirect kind of commands, where we have a very specific idea of maybe what that means, but there's no way for a kid to understand like what that looks like. And if they've been in different homes where different people had different expectations, it can be really confusing.
It can.
So I think that for us to be able to kind of define those things and also timing of those expectations. I know some parents have like a rule list of like 20 or 30 rules when a kid comes into their home, and they kind of like have it laminated and they show it to them. And I'm thinking, that's really overwhelming for a kid. Like you should maybe think about your top rule for safety and then that be the thing that you introduce when they get there. Mm-hmm. But respect is definitely one of those things that I hear a lot about, or being disrespected. And I think it often has to come down to, can the child do the thing that you're asking for based on their age? And is it clear to them what behavior it is that you're looking for? If not, then they're probably going to fail. Mm-hmm. And we can't fault them for that because we haven't made it clear enough.
It also seems to me that respect goes two ways. And sometimes I listen to the way parents talk to their children. And
sure.
I think,
modeling.
That is disrespectful, the way that you're speaking to your child. Mm-hmm. So respect goes both ways. And And that is one way to introduce it, is that in our family, we don't yell at someone, you know.
Yes.
Our family, when we're angry, we try to talk in a nice voice or whatever, we don't say, I hate you, when we're angry or something, whatever it is in your family that you as a parent also would be willing to.
Exactly. That's such a good point. And I would say I've even seen it in emotion regulation kind of problems where we're trying to teach kids or like notice when they're getting emotionally dysregulated. Uh-huh. And parents are on board that they want to see kids do this, but parents aren't good at it. So I've seen parents sometimes say, you know, like, Johnny, you're getting upset. You need to use a coping skill. Calm down. And they're like, but they're yelling.
Yeah, so just thinking, like my daughter yelled, ignored that you're yelling, cope, cope.
Exactly. Calm down. You need to be calm. Your body needs to be calm. Your voice needs to be calm. And so I'm thinking, you know, like, yes, and is the way that we're approaching it helping them to feel calm? Or are we giving them something else to feel not so calm about? So yeah, I do think but it's not like it's easy for us to be able to kind of do these things naturally, but as we think about kids coming into our care, the experiences they've had with other caregivers, where maybe they have learned that adults are not safe, mm-hmm. that if I act a certain way long enough, they will send me to a different home, that, you know, adults are people that you can't really count on. Those are maybe beliefs. And with the National Child Traumatic Stress Network and other groups that do this work more often, they have coined terms like the invisible suitcase. Those the beliefs that kids have about themselves, about caregivers, and about the world that are in this invisible suitcase before they ever come to your home, they are looking to see if you're going to confirm any of those beliefs in their suitcase about adults, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. themselves, or about the world. And the minute that you do, then that helps kind of justify, yep, see, adults can't be counted on. Mm-hmm. Adults do give up. I can show enough of a behavior that they won't change mm-hmm. their mind about me being able to stay here. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate because it kind of leads to all kinds of negative outcomes that we know happen for kids that have multiple placement changes. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we're really committed to within the network and some of the work that I do is how do we help support resource parents to be trauma informed so they don't make that phone call to the child welfare worker and say, I am done parenting today.
Yeah.
Today is the last day of my parenting. I'm not giving a week's notice. Today's the day.
Yep.
That is what we are trying to avoid. That is what we're trying to reduce. And I do think that these strategies, like the ones we're talking about today and the others that I know that you promote on the other parts of your work, are hopefully ways that we can minimize mm-hmm. or keep from taking kids and families down that path.
You're right. You are so right that once parents, or at least our experience is that once parents reach that point where they've thrown in the towel, all the advice, everything, it's useless. At that point, they have given up. And so the key, and this is preaching to the choir, I realize, but the key is to reach parents before, to provide support, to step in, to give them information, to give them training, to give them support before they reach the point of picking up the phone and saying, get this kid out by 5 today. Yeah. Yeah. Let me pause here for a minute, guys. You've heard me say it before because it is so true. This show truly would not happen without the support of our partners who believe in our mission of providing you unbiased, expert-based, trauma-informed information. One such partner is Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years experience helping to create families. They offer home study only services as well as full service infant adoption, international home studies, and post-adoption support. They also have a foster to adopt program. You can find them online at vistadelmar.org/adoption. Thank you. So tell us more about the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, because everybody is going to be, people who have listened to this show as well as have checked mm-hmm. out Creating a Family are well familiar with it because we refer your resources, or not yours, but their resources frequently. Mm-hmm. But tell us more about it.
Yeah. So this is a congressionally mandated, federally funded network through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. that's been around for around 20 plus years. And there are 140 funded centers across the country that do this work, and about maybe that much or more of previously funded or affiliate sites that are very active. And their mission is to increase access and quality of evidence-based treatments and practices for kids who've experienced trauma, and have public-facing resources that are really helpful to understand how to talk with kids about a number of things for different audience groups, thinking about for child welfare, for juvenile justice, for mental health, for parents, for court systems, how to talk with kids about COVID, how to talk with kids about sexual abuse, all kinds of free webinars and other types of resources that they have as well. So I would really encourage folks to check out those resources and products that are, again, publicly available because it's a federally funded network. But these are treatment developers. These are community providers. These are family members. These are foster youth who've aged out of care that are all working together in this network to try to provide the best education and resources and treatments and responses to kids who've experienced trauma in their families. So I think that it is the single best resource that I can think of for any of those groups that might want to know a little bit more about what is child trauma and how do we respond.
And that website is nctsn.org, National Child Traumatic Stress Network, nctsn.org. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Tripp Aik, for being with us today to talk about this really important topic. I truly appreciate your time. So thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thank you.
And for our audience, I'll see you next week.